Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Friday, February 20, 2015. South Sudan government delegation to the Addis peace talks are demanding new conditions.
Upon our arrival, we need to know with whom are we going to negotiate. There are already two factions, and these two factions are there, and as such, we would not just go and start talking, but we will go and talk with the rebels when they have put their house in order.
And East African community leaders meet in Nairobi to decide on the fate of South Sudan.
I'll be very comfortable as an East African, as a Tanzanian, to see Somalia and the Southern Sudan improve their security situation before joining the East African community.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. A government official who is attending the South Sudan peace talks in Addis Ababa says a recent defection from rebel leader Riek Machar's team could derail the talks. As Waki Simon Wudu reports from Juba, Makui told reporters at Juba Airport before leaving for Addis Ababa that he hopes a final peace deal will be signed in March.
South Sudan's Information Minister Michael Makuei apparently was referring to a recent announcement by Brigadier General Lulu Roy Kwong, the former military spokesman for South Sudan's Amti opposition, saying he was defecting from the group to conclude that the rebel faction's ranks are beginning to splinter.
There is a split already in the rebel ranks. And this split may have an effect in a way or the other on the peace talks.
Makuei says the split is likely to derail the talks.
Upon our arrival, we need to know with whom are we going to negotiate. There are already two factions, and these two factions are there. And as such, we would not just go and start talking, but we will go and talk with the rebels when they have put their house in order.
Brigadier General Kwong announced his defection from rebel forces on Wednesday and said he was establishing a different faction. However, he has not appeared at the talks with any new faction. The talks are scheduled to get underway in earnest over the weekend and are expected to result in a comprehensive peace agreement to end a 14-month-long conflict in South Sudan. President Salva Kiir and rebel leader Riek Machar met last month in Addis Ababa, where they signed a framework agreement which the two sides say should pave the way for reaching a comprehensive peace agreement. Makuei questions many issues have yet to be resolved.
We are going today to start negotiations on the outstanding issues which we left in the Rainbow Document. So we are going to discuss issues of structures, issues of the establishment and the composition of the government of national unity, and issues of federalism, issues of security arrangements and economic arrangements.
Makuei says the hope is to strike a deal by the IGAD-imposed March 5th deadline. The off-again-on-again talks have continued for more than a year with little progress to show for them. Makuei says despite a recommitment to a cessation of hostilities agreement, fighting continues in Upper Nile State, and he accused the rebels of launching those attacks.
It is since last week that the rebels continued attacking our positions in western Upper Nile, that is in the area of Halouf, in the area of Kaka, in the area of Reng in northern Upper Nile. Even this morning, they attack our positions in Nasir. But nevertheless, all these attacks, all these violations will not change the position of the government in search of peace.
The two sides are slated to announce a transitional government of national unity by April of this year. It remains to be seen whether that will happen. For VOA News, I am Wake Simon Wodo in Juba.
But the rebels are downplaying Lul Kong's defection. Ezekiel Lulgatkwot, the deputy secretary of the opposition's external relations committee, says Kwong's defection has no bearing on the peace talks.
Maybe you have heard from him when he went to Juba that he came alone and he's by himself together with his wife. He did not have a single human being with him, even a bodyguard, to go and protect him in Juba. He does not have any impact. He's just a lone ranger.
The talks in the Ethiopian capital were supposed to get underway yesterday, but was delayed because government negotiators were not present at the venue. Galkot says SPLM in opposition delegations are in Addis ready to go.
Our delegation is here. There is no split at all. Our delegation is here. Actually, we are waiting for the delegation of the government. Our chairman is here. Our delegation is here. And but the government delegation, they are not yet in Addis. We are being told that they are going to arrive today in the evening. And then maybe we will start late in the evening or tomorrow morning. But basically, we are here and we are waiting for the government delegation to start the talks. We are ready.
AGAD officials who have been mediating the talks say they are confident the two sides will come up with a comprehensive peace agreement in the latest round of talks. The AGAD chairperson, Ethiopian Prime Minister Haile Mariam Desalegn, recently urged the two leaders to respect what they have signed. At the signing of the framework agreement, he said the people of South Sudan and the international community are expecting them to sign a final comprehensive peace agreement. Desalegn warned failure to do so will have grave consequences to all of us and specifically to the leaders of South Sudan. VOA fellow Lucy Pony prepared this report. Heads of state from five East and Central African nations are meeting in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi, to discuss some crucial regional issues, including South Sudan's and Somalia's long-awaited admission to the East African Community. The East African Community is a regional bloc created for trade and cooperation among East African nations. As Lucy Pony reports, it's not at all clear that South Sudan will be granted admission to the East African Community before it settles its troubles at home.
Most of the East African ministers emphasized that Somalia and South Sudan should solve their internal problems and restore lasting peace and stability before they are admitted into the five-nation regional body. Leaders at the Nairobi EAC meeting are also discussing a trade dispute between Tanzania and Kenya. Kenya recently banned Tanzania-registered tour vehicles from accessing Jomo Kenyatta International Airport as well as the country's national parks. Tanzanian delegates at the meeting say the trade dispute with Kenya is being handled through diplomatic channels. EAC leaders are expected to make a final decision as to whether Somalia and South Sudan should be admitted as member states of the regional bloc at this month's summit. Uganda's Minister of East African Community Affairs, Shem Bageine, explains why he doubts Somalia and South Sudan will meet the conditions for membership.
We had selected a team from the partner state to go and carry out the verification exercise. Unfortunately, because of some problems in Somalia, the team could not go. And until it goes, we cannot proceed. South Sudan, we concluded the verification and they made the criteria for joining the community. We were moving to the second stage, which was the negotiations with them. Unfortunately, misunderstandings arose in the country, which were setback. We are still waiting until they are clear, then we can start the negotiations.
The Tanzanian Minister for the East African Community agrees with his Ugandan counterpart. Harrison Mwachembe says leaders of Somalia and South Sudan have the huge double task of improving security and creating a good environment for trade with other East African nations. He says the vetting process for membership is quite transparent.
Our decision-making in the East African Community is consensus. We sit down together and we come to conclusion. We are looking at those applications and we shall treat these applications with the respect, with the seriousness they deserve. I'll be very comfortable as an East African, as a Tanzanian, to see Somalia and Southern Sudan improve their security situation before joining the East African Community.
Kenyan diplomat Abdi Ali Abdi is asking the EAC to give both countries more time to put their houses in order. He says the Somali government has made significant progress and should be granted admission to the East African Community, but he worries about admitting South Sudan to the EAC.
Still, I don't think it will take a process, but South Sudan is a different case from Somalia. A bit Somalia is a bit okay, and now they are somehow stable. There's African Union there, peacekeeping. The Somali government is at least improving, so not bad. Joining is not something you can easily rush.
But South Sudan is not stable. Government and rebel forces have been fighting each other for more than 14 months, leaving more than 10,000 people dead, including many civilians. The East African Community is an intergovernmental organization comprised of Burundi, Kenya, Rwanda, Tanzania, and Uganda. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta is the EAC's current chairman. The organization was originally founded in 1967. It collapsed in 1977, but was revived again in July 2000. For VOA News, I'm Lucy Pony.
The audio for this report was provided to South Sudan in Focus, courtesy of a Kenyan freelance journalist and writer, James Shimanyola. Somali officials say at least six people have been killed, including deputy mayor of Mogadishu, and a dozen of others wounded in an attack on a hotel frequented by Somali government workers and politicians. For VOA News, Muhammad Yusuf reports from Nairobi. We are having some technical problem here in the studio, but we will get back to that story shortly.
Witnesses say a car parked with explosives blew up at the central hotel as people finished praying Friday. Then a gun battle broke out between the attackers and security forces. The spokesman for the security forces, Kasim Ahmed Joble, told the US Somali service it is not clear how the attackers got into the hotel compound. He says they're investigating who detonated the car bomb and how. Government security officials are admitting they're investigating the attack and questioning hotel guards. Robles says Deputy Mayor Mohamed Aden Gulaid is among the dead. Three cabinet ministers were wounded in the attack. Robles says two members of parliament are among the dead. No cabinet minister was killed. This is the second attack on a hotel in Mogadishu in less than a month. In late January, three people were killed when a suicide car bomber blew himself up at the gate of a hotel housing a Turkish delegation. None of the delegation was injured. Somali officials had just begun looking for ways to improve security within the city because more top foreign government officials have been visiting. In the past few weeks, the government has made significant changes to how security forces protect the population. There has been a heavier presence of security forces on Mogadishu streets, working to stop bomb and gun attacks and assassinations. Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for Friday's attack. Despite losing more ground to African Union troops and Somali forces, the rebel group continues to carry out attacks on government and civilian targets in Somalia, in what it says is an effort to establish Islamic law. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You're tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The World Health Organization approves a new test kit for Ebola. That story is coming up when we come back.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
would you invest in solar-powered energy devices?
Of course I would invest, since you found that electricity for 3 days, no electricity. So yeah, solar is the best thing, and I would like to invest if I have the power to do it.
Solar power devices, these are good things to use according to the environmental changes. Solar energy can be good because you are able to conserve the energy somewhere in the battery and then use some other time later.
Because when I have a solar, I will not use money. I will just put it outside there, and at night, that solar will provide us a light. And we will charge our phone there. Even we will do our thing there. We will read. The kid will read.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus. The World Health Organization has approved the first rapid test kit for use in Ebola-affected countries in West Africa. WHO says the test will significantly speed up the process of testing people who have become infected with the deadly Ebola virus. Lisa Schlein reports from WHO headquarters in Geneva.
The World Health Organization calls this new antigen rapid test a breakthrough in efforts to detect the Ebola virus, which has infected more than 23,200 people and killed 9,365 in Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea over the past year. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich tells VOA the test is not perfect, but good enough to make a significant difference.
The test can correctly identify 92% of Ebola-infected patients and 85% of those not infected with the virus. So it is, again, less accurate, but the advantages outweigh the risks.
Jazarevich says the rapid test should later be confirmed by the standard laboratory test that detects the virus's nucleic acid or genetic material. He says it is more accurate, but also more complex to use. He says the so-called PCR tests are performed in well-established laboratories and require fully trained personnel to administer them. In addition, he notes it takes between 12 and 24 hours to get results, unlike the rapid test, which can give results in 15 minutes and is much easier to apply.
It's easy to perform, does not require electricity, and it can be therefore used in lower healthcare facilities, lower level of healthcare facilities, or in mobile units for patients in remote settings. And it doesn't really require the highly trained personnel as for the other one.
The new rapid test was developed by the U.S.-based Corgenix Medical Corporation. The World Health Organization evaluated this diagnostic product under its emergency assessment and use procedure that seeks to provide minimum quality, safety, and performance assurances. Jazarevich says the cost of the product has not yet been set. He says Corgenix currently is finishing some administrative procedures with the U.S. Food and Drug Administration, which has approved the safety of the diagnostic test. He says this should be completed within the next 2 weeks. After that, he says, the test will be available for purchase. He says the group Doctors Without Borders has expressed interest in buying it. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on health matters. Thus, a new study says victims of human trafficking suffer severe mental and physical health problems. Some estimates say at least 18 million men, women, and children worldwide are considered modern-day slaves. VOA's Joe DiCapua reports.
The study, published in the Lancet Global Health Medical Journal, is the largest ever done on the mental and physical health of trafficking victims. It's a joint effort by the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine and the International Organization for Migration. The findings focus on exploitation in Cambodia, Thailand, and Vietnam, but the people trafficked also included those from Burma and Laos. More than 1,000 people were interviewed. They had either escaped or were rescued from traffickers just weeks before the interviews. Dr. Leisha Kiss is a lecturer of social epidemiology at the London School and the study's lead author.
The people we interviewed were working in the different sectors. We had a large proportion in sex work, in fishing, in factory work, but we also interviewed people working in agriculture, bagging, domestic workers in construction, in home business, in restaurant and hospitality, and working as street sellers, and finally trafficked as wives.
While it's estimated 18 million people are trafficking victims, the study says the hidden nature of trafficking and the difficulties in defining it make estimates uncertain.
There is so little data on behalf of trafficked people, and we feel that the assistance that is provided to them needs to be better informed to the needs of this population.
Dr. Kiss says the survey of trafficking victims found they were highly traumatized. The study looked for signs of depression, anxiety, and post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD.
We found that a high proportion of our sample reported symptoms associated with these three conditions. For example, almost 60% of participants reported symptoms of depression. We had also high levels of post-traumatic stress disorder, and almost half of the sample reporting anxiety. Also, it caught our attention that one in six participants reported having thoughts of ending their lives in the 4 weeks prior to the interview, and 1 in 20 actually tried to kill themselves in the 4 weeks before the interviews.
She describes some of what the trafficking victims endured.
We know that they were living in very harsh conditions, living and sleeping in overcrowded rooms, sleeping in dangerous conditions, having nowhere to sleep, having poor basic hygiene, not having adequate water to drink, having insufficient food to eat, no clean clothing items, and having been overexposed to rain.
And then there's the physical abuse.
We had very high levels of violence reported as well. We had almost half of the sample reporting physical or sexual violence, or both of them. Almost half the men reported physical violence, and 44% of the adult women interviewed reported sexual violence. Among children, these numbers were very high as well, with 36% of children reporting either physical or sexual violence, or both.
KISS says very few received medical care for their injuries, except for such things as broken bones or loss of a body part. Researchers also asked how they became victims of traffickers.
So we asked about abduction, and we found that it was the minority of our sample that reported being abducted. The majority of people have situations at home that they're trying to improve. Sometimes family member who's ill, they need a better job, better financial conditions for their family, and that's why they decide to migrate.
It's during that migration, when encountering language, cultural, and financial barriers, that they may fall victim to traffickers. Dr. KISS says there is a huge need to invest in prevention measures. One reason is that after the trafficking victims have been freed, they return home to the same conditions that caused them to migrate in the first place. She says that puts them at risk of being trafficked yet again. The study recommends greater government regulation, the enforcement of stringent health and safety standards, and frequent inspections of labor sectors that are susceptible to human trafficking. While this study focuses on Southeast Asia, human trafficking occurs in many other places around the world. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
In December last year, an inmate serving a life sentence at a Kenyan prison escaped from his guards while taking an exam at a local university. No one knows where he is, but VOA's Gabe Joslow interviewed the prisoner last year and brings us his story about the challenges of life behind bars and what his experience may say about the Kenyan justice system.
Peter Kamau Ndungu was a model inmate at Naivasha Maximum Prison in Kenya's Rift Valley. He had already received a professional certificate in accounting and was studying for a bachelor's degree in commerce. During his third-year exams at the University of Nairobi, he slipped away.
Well, he went into the classroom like he had done for 2 years.
This is Patrick Mwenda, officer in charge of Naivasha Prison.
My men were there, but you know the class had several students. And usually the guards used to wait for him outside, and it has not been a problem, really. But that day, he decided to do the opposite. He took off.
Mwenda said the escape came as a shock to him. Ndungu had always been a perfect inmate. He taught other prisoners about accounting and volunteered in the prison's administrative office. Mwenda and the other prison guards even supported his education, organizing a harambe, a traditional Kenyan fundraising event, to help pay for his studies.
Oh, yeah, we did. In fact, everybody is annoyed. He's really annoyed. The spiritual people, the guards, myself, and all friends. You know, we raised our 400,000 Kenya shillings. That's not very true money in our country.
As they were ruling Kenya.
During a visit to the prison in October, the corrections officers and inmates could not wait to introduce VOA reporters to Ndungu. Amid the noise and clamor of the prison schoolhouse, he sat quietly in a corner of the library, helping another student with his accounting work. He said he could get most of the material he needed, but studying in this environment was a challenge.
Well, you know, prison is prison. This is a penal institution. You can't expect all the comforts one gets outside there while studying here. And considering that I'm alone, there's no one else who is studying what I'm doing here.
Ndungu was arrested in 1999 and charged with robbery with violence. He insisted he was innocent.
You know, that is the most painful part of my story, because I came here because of something I didn't do.
As Ndungu tells it, a car connected to the robbery was found on his family's property. The police rounded up all the young men in the neighborhood. He said those who were able to pay off the cops were let go.
I went to court, and in court, when you get there and you don't have money, it used to be you have money, you get freed. You don't have money, you get convicted. That's how it happened.
Although nobody was killed, he was initially sent to death row, a sentence that was later converted to life in prison. After exhausting his appeals, Ndugu's only hope was Kenya's Power of Mercy Committee, an advisory board set up in 2011 to recommend prisoners for presidential pardons.
My only avenue is through the Power of Mercy Committee. Since its establishment about, when was it, about three or so years ago, they have released several people, but I don't know why. I've been left behind always, and I don't think there is any prisoner in Kenya who has struggled with education the way I have. I think I've done enough.
And he was a good candidate. In fact, in what may actually be the most painful part of his story, prison officer Mwenda said he would have presented the case to the committee had Ndungu not decided to escape.
Yeah, if he didn't. In fact, I was waiting for him to graduate possibly this year or early next year. And it was a case we were very ready to present and really push it to ensure that he is released. But now there we are.
But there is no guarantee of a pardon in Kenya. According to a report in Kenya's Daily Nation newspaper, more than 3,000 inmates applied to the Power of Mercy last year. Only a handful will be released. Nobody knows or will say where Ndungu has gone to now, but it seems like he chose a life on the run rather than face the uncertainty of Kenyan justice. Gabe Joslo, VOA News, Nairobi.
And that report by Gabe Joslo brings us to the end of our show for this Friday. We now leave you with the song A Shower by a traditional Zande group from Western Equatoria State. Been listening to a traditional Zande group performing the song Ashawo. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Have a peaceful weekend, and we'll see you next week for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.